Discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. You should always consult with an investment professional before making important investment decisions. Securities offered through J.W. Cole Financial, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI, an SEC-registered investment advisor. 674 South College Avenue, Bloomington, Indiana. Hello, everyone. It's the Big Investment Show. Thank you for joining me, Your Money with David Hayes. Rod Holloway will be joining me in just a few minutes, the Equity Portfolio Manager of CFCI, our firm. And then later on, Eric Giesler, our fixed income dude, will be joining us to give us a little insight on what he thinks will happen with interest rates and those interest-sensitive investments that are out there. So it is the first week of the month, and we try to talk about investments each and every time. We have some great shows lined up coming up. We have Jerry Sedler, the author of Don't Retire, Rewire, in a couple of weeks. So if you're kind of struggling with this idea of retirement, not so much from a financial standpoint, but just from a time, what am I going to do with myself standpoint, you won't want to miss that show. That's in 2 weeks. Ed Slott, the country's IRA distribution expert, he was scheduled originally to be on next week, but I got a call from his office and that he is actually knee-deep into tax season right now. So we booted him until later this month or early into next month. So we'll be planning a show on the fly this week. But I promise, sometimes those are the best shows. We come up with some really good topics, things we haven't talked about for a while. So again, tune in next week, and it will be a surprise on what we're going to be talking about. Let's do a little news of the week, of course, brought to you by Lance Like of the Like Law Group. Give yourself and your family the peace of mind that comes with proper estate planning. Call my friend Lance at the Like Law Group, 323-8300. Well, U.S. stocks climbed on Thursday after two sessions of losses as jobless claims raised some optimism ahead of key payroll reports. Oil also tumbled on fears of a worsening oversupply as the sanctions in Iran, we're going to be talking about this later, are likely to drop. So data showed an unexpected fall in the number of Americans filing for new claims for unemployment that boosted sentiment before the U.S. Labor Department's non-farm payroll report for March, which is actually going to be released on Good Friday. Of course, on Good Friday, the U.S. and European stock markets will be closed. Greece has told its creditors it will be out of cash on April 9th, making an appeal for more loans before reforms on which new disbursements hinge are agreed and implemented. But the request was denied by Eurozone officials. The appeal was made by Athens at a teleconference of Eurozone deputy finance ministers on Wednesday. And they basically said, we're going to be out of cash, so we have a choice to make. Later this week, meaning next week, that they'll either have to pay back 450 million euros to the International Monetary Fund on April 9th or pay salaries and pensions, and they said they would choose to do the latter. Interesting. We'll see how that all shakes out. Radio Shack is dead, but long live Radio Shack. A new version of the chain will debut this month under ownership of Standard General with assist from Sprint. According to plans filed with the bankruptcy court, the stores will look a lot like the streamlined outlets Radio Shack tried to build right before it ran out of cash. They're going to be doing things like, you know, just sell. This is going to be kind of a cool little hip shop. That's what they're trying to get after. So good luck to Radio Shack. And then finally, NFL star Dwight Freeney sues Bank of America and Merrill Lynch, his financial advisor, for more than $20 million in their alleged role in leading him into a massive fraud that brought him to the brink of bankruptcy. Mr. Freeney said that the bank's global wealth and investment division played an integral and indispensable part of the scheme. This comes out of Investment News, as they aided and abetted a fraudster who siphoned off more than $8.5 million from his accounts. In 2010, Dwight Freeney authorized the Bank of America to manage his assets, including his NFL salary. 2 years later, Dwight had lost more than $20 million. In the latest development in a series of court battles that have gone on since 2012, when the FBI arrested former Merrill Lynch advisor Ava Weinberg and her associate Michael Stern. They're both currently serving time in prison after pleading guilty to their roles in defrauding Dwight Freeney, according to the complaint. Bank of America has yet to file a response, but spokesman William Halden denied any wrongdoing, of course. Although we sympathize with Mr. Freeney as a victim of a crime, the bank had nothing to do with the criminal scheme, Mr. Halden said in an email statement. The primary wrongdoer never worked for the bank and any of its affiliates, and the other person committed in the crime left Merrill Lynch before that happened. Mr. Freeney entered the NFL in 2002, of course, as a first-round draft pick for our Indianapolis Colts, where he played defense for 11 seasons. He signed a $34 million contract back in 2007. You know, he said he came to Bank of America in 2010 as a 29-year-old because he had already had numerous bad experience with prior financial managers and was seeking help from a larger, well-established firm. You know, folks, this story is over and over and over and over. And Tim Duncan of the NBA has had a recent experience. And, you know, Tim's a smart guy. Freeney's a smart guy. I'm not so sure if the NFL just shouldn't, and the NBA shouldn't just take this financial management in-house. I think there's 32 NFL teams. What if they just all had an in-house financial advisor, paid him a couple $100,000, and that was their financial coach? I think that's the solution to this matter. Just make it mandatory. This is what they have to do, because we have seen so much of this over the years, and it's really, really sad when a person who's making, you know, a couple $1 million a year with a nice signing bonus, and that's not everybody, but that's the guys that we hear about on the news, you know, they only have a working life of about 10 years. They have to save it. They have to continue to educate themselves, and I'm telling you, there's got to be something to fix that problem. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, it is The Investment Show. Rod Holloway will be joining me live on the radio as soon as he shows up, or he's going to call in. I think the line just fired up, so maybe that's the plan. Hot Rod is on the fly. We'll be back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. All right, welcome back, everyone. It is The Investment Show, and I've been surrounded by two pretty smart guys, Eric Giesler, our fixed income manager over at the office, and Rod Holloway, which, of course, you hear Rod on Glass in the Morning every Monday and Friday morning to give an update on the markets. So Eric Giesler joins us now live on the radio, and Hot Rod is now in studio. Hey, Eric, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you so much for having me, and Rod, thank you for accommodating me.
Yeah, kind of our schedules, it's not always easy to coordinate everybody's schedules, and that and a Thursday night 6 o'clock show, we pulled it off once again. Eric, let's talk a little bit about the Fed. You know, and you and I have talked about this for a long time, that I'm not so sure what the Fed is doing will really matter a lot in long-term interest rates. And I get that question nearly every single day when someone walks into the office and they sit down and they say, what's going to happen when the Fed starts raising rates? And I look across the table and in a very nice way and say, probably not much. What's your take on that?
Well, and I think you'll see this almost on a number of different issues, but what it does is bring two or three days of volatility to the market, depending on whether the bias was in agreement with what the Federal Reserve had to say, and there'll be two or three days of changing strategies and platforms in terms of asset allocation talked about, but nothing really ever happens when the Fed makes an announcement here on a quarterly basis. They've tried to be more transparent here over the last few years, but I think in some ways it's actually probably added more anticipation or confusion to the market.
So what does the Fed really control, Eric? What kind of interest rates do they actually control? Sans the idea of bond buying.
Well, they establish the rate at which banks can borrow between themselves. And that's it. In terms of anything that is, in terms of treasury rates or any bond rates or any other rate, they don't control that. The only thing that they can control is the interest rate that banks pay each other when they borrow from each other.
Now, when we talk about interest rates, Eric, I know as we've unfolded this week, you know, the 10-year Treasury, which is a terrific benchmark for folks to listen or watch and to gauge, like, maybe what their mortgage rates could be the following week, it continues to be down under 2%. I saw the 5-year Treasury was up close to maybe 1.5. I don't have the exact number in front of me. The 30-year Treasury is down, what is it? Is it, what is it, around 3 or something?
It's a little less than 3 today.
Yeah, so when you look at this what you would call the interest rate curve, it just doesn't seem to be budging upward, and that doesn't kind of jive with people's opinions, again, when they're sitting across from me in my office and they're saying, well, you know, isn't the economy improving? Shouldn't we be worried about inflation? The bond market's telling us just a complete opposite.
Well, I think the bond market is telling you, and we really have gone to a global perspective on many things, whether it's in equities that we now have so many companies that are now global or whether it's bonds that are being traded, whether it's Apple being traded in Europe and so on and so forth. So we really do end up with a global perspective of many things across the board. And I think what the markets are telling us from an interest rate perspective is that globally there is very little growth. As we know, there are probably many examples that we can talk about of countries or sovereign nations that are struggling with having any growth at all. And I think that overflows into our economy and our perspective in terms of investments. So, I do believe that we've got a global perspective in terms of where is growth. Yes, the United States is doing okay, but the rest of the world isn't, and the rest of the world is somewhat dependent upon each other, and I think it's reflected in the market.
You know, Eric, I know our crystal ball is just as foggy as everyone else's, but when you look at what you just said, looking forward, can you really see interest rates going up that much? I mean, at the beginning of the year, almost everyone, with the exception of a few people, were predicting that rates would be, you know, quite a bit higher by the end of 2015 than we started off the year.
Well, from my perspective, I don't see a big change. Now, is that 25 basis points or 40 basis points one way or the other? I don't see a big change. Could there be a moment or an announcement or a war breaks out someplace that changes that? Sure, there is. But in terms of growth, and I think that it's what's absent much of the markets, both equity and bond markets today, is many of the fundamentals have been kind of lost and overlooked because of so much of what those central banks are doing, whether they're adding money or subtracting money from their supplies. You have a Japanese market now where the central bank is actually buying individual equities. And there's some thoughts that, you know, that's a little bit manipulative when a nation comes in and has their central bank start picking winners and losers. So I think that the overall market is really keeping an eye on what are the central banks doing and not so much fundamentally what's happening with an individual company or earnings or any of those things. I think it's more about the central banks today.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, it is the investment show. We want to talk about investments with Eric Giesler, our fixed income manager over at CFCI. So when we come back, I want to talk about individual bonds. And when we talk about risk, you know, folks, we all understand market risk because that's what you see every single day. But there's also another risk called liquidity risk. And that's one thing that Eric's been seeing a lot of in the market recently. We're going to talk about that and how the risk of forced selling by managers when you're in their fund, how that can affect you. We're going to take a break, come back. We'll talk about that, and then we'll get over to Hot Rod Holloway and talk about the fun stuff, which is the stock market and earnings and all those kind of things that we all like to talk about and follow. We'll be back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. You know, as we talk about risk in the market, and Rod's with me now, Rod, most people understand volatility. I mean, that's the name of the equity game, right?
Oh, yeah.
But when you think about other risk, you know, in the bond world, you talk about credit risk, and you're talking about, you know, interest rate risk. But, Eric, I want you to talk a little bit about liquidity risk. You know, that's something that people just don't get their hands around very easily, including financial advisors. And I think in some cases, people could be putting their money at risk and they not even know it. So take just a second and talk a little bit about your liquidity concerns.
Well, one of the things that resulted from the crisis of 2008 and 2009 is that regulators and governments around the world wanted banks to improve their balance sheets and have more reserves. And one of the things that they've asked banks to do is to hold less inventory, fewer securities in inventory or on their balance sheet. And in enabling them to do that, they've asked them to raise more capital and to hold more government debt. And so the ability to inventory bonds, if there is a need to buy and sell bonds, one of the things that banks and as well as governments around the world provided was liquidity, so that people could sell their bonds if they needed to in order to raise cash. And because of regulation and also because countries around the world used a lot of their reserves or a lot of their capital to stimulate their economies, there are fewer and fewer places to hold inventory and to make available the liquidity or the cash that will allow you and I and others who want to trade our securities. It will be more difficult because those inventories are not available to us. And as you look around the world, we now have more debt than ever in the history of the world. And I'm not talking about the United States. We're talking about globally. We have more debt outstanding. We have huge capitalization in the equity market. So if there is a concern or something comes up, once again, if a war breaks out, where is the liquidity? Who's going to be there to buy the assets that we're trying to sell as individuals and as a nation? Where is that liquidity going to come from? And that is growing smaller and smaller.
So is this a case for buying individual bonds over owning a bond fund? Because one of the things I've been reading a lot about, and Rod, you can chime in here too, that as if flows slow down or start to reverse in fixed income funds, and you're in an illiquid market and you have a fund manager trying to sell bonds, it just starts to be this major spiraling effect downward in values versus owning an individual bond. Yeah, the value might go down, but as long as you hang on to it, you know, maturity bails you out of a lot of things. Is that something people need to be aware of?
Yes, and I also think there's a more important aspect of it, and I've heard Rod say this. You want to own things that you're willing to hang on to, that you won't necessarily feel desperate that you absolutely have to sell something. I think that's, if I was to give any advice, buy things that you want to own and hold. Because if you're owning something that you don't want to hold for very long and there's a liquidity problem, you're going to get stuck holding something you don't want to hold.
So, folks, listen to this. Talk to your advisors about it. Understand it, that there is a risk of liquidity, especially in these pooled funds. And, Rod, I don't know if you want to add anything, but I know this is
what
I
was
going
to add is part of what Eric just described there also is what is going to add to that liquidity issue, which is when you do or if, but most people are predicting at some point in time, this great rotation of the retail investor pulling money out of the bond funds and shifting it towards equities. If that's important and people are only going to buy things they feel comfortable owning for a long term, well, when that bond fund manager is forced to sell because of redemptions, what's he going to have to sell? He's
going
to have to sell his best stuff.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, so the high quality stuff gets bought because people are willing to own that until maturity and own it forever and feel comfortable, which then dries up the liquid investments, because what Eric is seeing in the bond world right now is there's not a lot of trading. It's not buying and selling. It's holding and buying, looking for quality, buying and adding to what you have. As your cash builds up, you wait for that versus, you know, years ago, a lot of trading would go on. You'd buy something, you'd hold it, you'd make some money, you'd sell it, you'd look for other opportunities. And Eric just isn't seeing that a whole lot out there. So part of what he just described to you is actually going to make that liquidity problem a slightly bigger problem if and when we do see this great rotation from the bond funds into the equity funds.
Eric, so I guess you just need to have a lot of cash on hand so when all these forced sellers come out and they're selling it cheap, we can swoop
in
and buy it up.
That's exactly right.
Well, Big E, hey, thanks for taking the time. Happy Easter, happy Good Friday, and I'll see you next week sometime.
You got it. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, buddy.
Thanks, Ron.
Yep.
We'll take a break, guys. When we come back, again, I promise this, we'll shift over and talk about some of the fun stuff. We're going to take a review of the first quarter. Believe it or not, is it in the bank? We're going to be talking volatility. There's a lot of it out there right now. And not to be afraid of it, but to embrace it. And then also we're going to ask the question and hopefully answer it, what your expectations should be. And, you know, last year was a really strange year in the market because the S&P did so well and some of the other areas didn't. Well, this year it's kind of flipped up on its head, and that's why you have to remain diversified and know that some years you're going to look back and say, gosh, why didn't I do that? That's just the way it goes. We're going to try to clear all that up. We'll be back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. It is the Investment Show. The first week of the month, we always try to pull it off. And Rod Holloway, the equity portfolio guy over at CFCI, is joining me now live in studio. And Rod, I know the first quarter, believe it or not, is in the bank. And now we're back on to the second quarter looking at earnings again. It seems like every time I turn around, we're waiting for earnings to come out. Getting a little monotonous.
Yeah, exactly. That's just us getting older and time passing faster and faster every single year.
As you as you look at the last quarter, and I think this is where the tale of being diversified makes a lot of sense. You know, last year the S&P rocked, but other areas like international, small cap, you know, the Russell didn't do so hot. So a well-diversified growth portfolio probably clocked in at between 5 and 8%. And, you know, you looked at that and say, wait a second, I only made 7%? I thought the market did 13. Well, the S&P did 13. Well, now, Hot Rod, as we come out of the gate, I'm sure glad that I own a little bit of that NASDAQ, and I'm glad I own a little bit of that international, and maybe glad that I don't own so much S&P.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and that's where it gets difficult. So many people want to benchmark their portfolio to the S&P 500, but is that really the type of investor you are? I mean, the S&P 500, it's 500 large-cap stocks. Mm-hmm. I mean, high quality, good companies in there, nothing wrong with them, nothing wrong with owning those types of stocks. But is that what you are, especially if you're in retirement? Probably not. You're probably a balanced investor. So you're not going to want to benchmark your portfolio and the performance and how it does to S&P 500 if you've got a 50-50 mix. And in addition to that, as you were alluding to, not only the equity side, even if you don't own any bonds, you're still in that accumulation mm-hmm. phase and you're investing in your 401k and you're well diversified and you've got international and emerging markets and large cap and small cap and mid cap and all of that. Yeah, you underperformed last year, and you look and go, why did I do so poorly? And this is where the retail guy has to be cautious, because what does he tend to do at the end of the year when he does that? Well, he goes back, he sells that small cap, he sells that international,
and I buy more of that good stuff,
and he buys more of that large cap stuff, which mimics the S&P 500.
Yeah, look how good this is doing. No, honey, it's not doing anything. It did that.
So this year, first quarter, S&P 500, 0.04% year to date. Small cap, though, you're talking about 3.5% roughly, or actually almost 4%. International, 3.5%. So yeah, if you throw those out at the end of the year because they underperformed last year, well, you're flat year to date with your new investments, mm-hmm. while the things you got rid of are the ones that have been leading the market so far. And to just touch on one other thing from the standpoint of volatility, which you mentioned, and I've mentioned this on Glass's show quite a bit. Volatility, when you get all of these 100-point, 200-point moves up or down, like we have consistently got these first 3 months, that tends to scare a lot of retail investors and causes them to get out. But as I just alluded to, where are we at year to date? We're flat.
Yeah.
You haven't lost any money. You haven't really made any money. But all of that volatility has shaken some people out of the equity market because they don't like these big moves. But the reality is they haven't hurt you in these big moves. The volatility gets a little bit exaggerated because that's how traders make money. Mm. Traders want the volatility there because they're making money in the short run. They're not buying a stock saying, you know what, this is a great company and I think their products are going to continue to do extremely well for the next 10 years. No, they're saying, hey, you know what? There's momentum behind this. I'm buying it today. I may sell it tomorrow. I may sell it in a week. And to make money in a week or a day, you need volatility. You need big moves.
Yeah, I think more than this recent volatility getting people a little bit nervous, I think coming off the cusp of a sixth-year bull run that has seen very little volatility, I know it's got to be coming. I know this big correction's coming. I know a bear market's coming. That, along with a little volatility, tends to shake things up. You know, with that six-year bull market, I know people are starting to wonder how to prepare for that possible bear market. The answer, folks, is not the way you think. The biggest mistake investors make, aside from not saving enough money, is trying to predict the market. So financial advisors, investment managers are saying, hey, you need to pick an all-weather portfolio. And this is it. I mean, this is the way it goes. We had a six-year run of very little volatility. This is the way it actually normally works. So embrace it. Don't run away from it.
Yeah, exactly right. You don't want to try and predict when should I be in all bonds, when should I be in all stocks. No, you want to set your allocation based on where you're at in your life, what risk you're able to stomach and take, and then get a well-balanced portfolio and go through that. Now, along the lines of what you're talking about, the six-year bull market, one, I have said for many a times, and some of the people I follow closely say this, and I believe into it, I don't think we're truly in a six-year bull market, because I figure, I determine the bottom of the market not in March of 2009 when we hit the lowest point number-wise on the S&P 500, but actually closer to the end of 2010, beginning of 2011, when you actually had earnings bottom out and start going up. So for me, that's the start of the bull market, is when earnings started to turn positive,
yeah, right.
And go up. The other thing is so many people are worried, oh, even if you think it's 6 years and you don't buy my theory of fundamentals and the earnings being the bottom of the market, the other thing that you have to look at is it appears as though we could be in a secular bull market. Secular bull markets run typically on average 14 to 16 years. Now, in a secular bull market, that does not mean you cannot have a negative quarter or you cannot have a negative year.
Even, sure.
You can have that. What it means is that the trend doesn't necessarily get interrupted. You're down for that year, but when you start drawing patterns, technical indicators, you haven't broken that upwards trend, and that seems to still be in place. Historically, secular bull markets are strong over the long term with an average annual return of something like 16%. A lot of people think the bull market in the 90s really started in the 90s. It really started in the 80s as far as a secular bull market goes. Go back and look at the 80s. Look at the crash of 1987. You can have some serious downside while still within a secular bull market. So if you'd have put your money in the early 80s and rode out some of those bumpy years, you had some outstanding returns when you got to the end of the 90s and the tech bubble burst.
Real quick, end of last year, we were talking investments. We said rebalance. We always suggest that. And we don't always mean rebalance just from stocks to bonds, but if you would rebalance in your equities as well, that's the right thing to do. So if you looked across the board and you said international, whew, that one stunk. NASDAQ, tech stuff, that wasn't too hot either. Russell, whatever. But S&P was great. But you did what you – I kept saying it was the most counterintuitive thing we do as people is to rebalance. Take the money out of the thing that's been doing the greatest and put it in the things that stink. But that's – even on the equity side, Hot Rod, is exactly what you should do. That helps create this all-weather portfolio. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about a lot of things. We have Europe on our mind. We're also going to be talking about energy and oil, and if there's an opportunity there, or maybe it's a little bit scary right now. And also, if you look inside the market, there's always a few areas that tend to be bubbly. And I want to talk to Rod about the biotech rally. Is it fueling some bubble worries? Because certainly that sector has been just on, I don't even know if fire is the right word. It has been on, I don't even know, volcanic mode. I mean, it's that hot. So we're going to take a break. We'll come back, talk you through this. This is Your Money with Dave Hayes. You know, remember when we started using stimulus here in the United States and what happened to our equity markets? They went off like a rocket ship. And here on the show, we talked about when Europe begins doing this, maybe their market might react the same way. And if you go back and listen a couple years ago, or maybe a year ago, year and a half ago, I said, you know, when everybody says something, it rarely happens. Well, it didn't happen right away. But finally, we talked about this a lot in the fall, that when they quit just using words and actually started taking action, we might see their market take off. And Rod, is exactly what we've seen over there in Europe. The UK markets, the Germany market, the France markets, I mean, they have been on a holy terror over there. And again, everyone's basing it on the monetary stimulus policies that are happening over there. You have some numbers to back it up.
Yeah, yeah. The Euro stocks index, which is like looking at our S&P or the New York Stock Exchange or one of those. It's just encompassing the European countries, so none of the other foreign countries. Your 12-month number, 16.5%. But you know what? In the last 3 months, over 18%. So you were pretty negative the majority of the last 12 months, and you picked up all that positive here in the last 3 months. So yeah, year to date, you're up a little bit over 18% in that European stock index and tracking that. Now, for some of you that may be owning an international fund or a pure Europe mutual fund, you've probably not seen an 18% gain year to date, because what this is doing, it is only looking exclusively
at their stock
at the price movement of the stock on the index. That's it. Has nothing to, there is no currency exchange involved in the index. But lo and behold, when you actually own the investment inside a mutual fund or however you're owning it, there is a currency impact on that, which right now, because the euro has dropped so much and the dollar has strengthened so much, you've lost a lot of that performance.
When you look at the euro, I don't remember where it started before all this got going, but let's call it a 140, 150 to 1. Now it's gotten down to 107 to 1, and some are predicting it will come to par with the dollar soon and possibly even go below 1 to 1. 30, 40% decline, which means if you translate it real simply, then that 18% turns into about a 14%, 13%. Still a good return. Again, a good case for diversification, but we talked about it. It's actually happening. I don't know if I'm not here to tell you that that's going to continue. But, you know, I think you got to have your foot in the door over there, Hot Rod.
Yeah, most definitely. And will it continue at that pace? Probably not. But will it continue? More than likely. I mean, and here's the thing. Are the problems in Europe solved right now?
Well, no. And that reminds me of 2009 when the market took off here. It was still terrible.
Yep.
I remember us saying we're not so sure that this is real.
Exactly. No problems were solved in March of 2009.
But all the easy money came in 2009.
When the S&P 500 hit its bottom.
Yep.
So the rate of recovery in 2009 was extremely fast. But, of course, here we are in 2015, and the rate of recovery didn't end in 2009 because we had such a strong run. It just slowed down the rate or the pace of those up years.
Yeah. And if you look at American multinational firms, and this kind of comes back to our own equity talk here in the U.S., they've lost $27 billion when they convert their 2014 foreign sales back into U.S. dollars. So it's definitely impacting things. And, you know, going back to the Fed talk, Eric, we let him go, but, and you and I talked about this too, behind closed doors, that the Fed has got to have some concern about the strengthening dollar. Strengthening dollar will hurt profitability of U.S. companies, which then could hurt U.S. stock prices, which then could hamper consumer confidence, which then could reduce consumer spending, which is our engine for which our economy grows. And they're not going to come out and say and promote a weak dollar, but I got to think that they're a little bit concerned about that, and that might keep their pace of raising interest rates down just a little bit. That's just a complete gut call there. I have no idea. Rod, let's talk a little bit about energy. Oil down to 50, just announced U.S., Iran probably coming up with some kind of a deal. You and I were watching this unfold just this afternoon, and you said, hey, I might lighten my energy load a little bit because this really could impact the supply side of the equation and drive oil prices even further down.
Yeah, potentially. And it's just something we're looking at, and I'm going to evaluate exactly where we're at. I don't necessarily want to be heavily overweight energy. So I'm not bailing on energy. I still like energy long term. I think it's potentially a short term thing. But yeah, if the deal goes through and the sanctions are removed, Iran has a lot of oil already sitting in oil tankers offshore, just sitting there. They can't do anything with it because they've had sanctions, so nobody can buy it. But there are a lot of countries chomping at the bit to do business with Iran. So as soon as the sanctions go away, China and some of these other countries that want to do business with them, they're going to come in and they're going to gobble up that oil. So you did see Brent drop quite a bit today. It didn't impact the energy stocks. They were predominantly positive today. So I don't know that it's a huge sell-off thing. Like I said, I'm not considering leaving the energy field altogether. I'm just going to evaluate what percent of the portfolios are dedicated to energy, and I don't want to be extremely overweight that sector right now because I do think that there is still some volatility, maybe some downside to come. But long term, I still think that's a great sector to be in, especially if you own quality.
Sure, and there's so many different ways to be involved in the energy sector, and we're not suggesting you go out and try to pick these companies. We think professionally managed funds are probably the right way to go. But you have transportation, you have the exportation of liquefied natural gas is still full speed ahead. I mean, they're building out ports as we speak. So it's not just the oil that you look at. There's a lot of other opportunities. And if, let's face it, if Europe is able at some point to get back on stable ground and start to grow, demand will start to go up. And, you know, China's been slowing down. I mean, there's like Rod said, long term, I think you're fine. But remember, there's two sides to this energy investment story. We talk about stocks all the time, Rod, but I'll tell you, I think there's some pretty good debt opportunities out there.
Yeah, most definitely. And that's an area that I would most definitely say seek a professional, seek someone who deals in that marketplace on a regular mm-hmm. basis. So a bond fund, maybe even one that dabbles in the distressed debt marketplace, because there are a lot of companies that right now their bonds are trading as if they're going out of business. But the reality is they're not all going out of business. A few are going to. I think it was last week or the week before, we had one or two small mm-hmm. energy companies already file bankruptcy. We haven't had many do it yet. We will have a few more if oil stays low for a long time or has another sell-off, dip into the 40s or even into the 30s that many people are predicting. We're going to lose some of those oil companies, but not all of them. So the guys who really know how to get in there and crunch the numbers, understand the hedging strategies that some of the energy companies have, understand their cash flow versus their expenses that they're committed to, the lines of credit that they have, how long they can survive, those types of things. The people that really understand that marketplace and understand looking at the financials and diving deep into it, they're going to find some golden opportunities out there.
They're going to make some money. When you look at any company, folks, there's this thing called the capital structure. And you can invest in a company a variety of different ways. We talk common stock a lot, but that's at the bottom of the stack. You have their senior collateralized debt. You have their debentures, which is unsecured debt, which is typically your bonds. You have preferred securities, you have convertibles, and then you have your common stock. So there's a lot of different ways to invest in a company. So if you look at a company and say, you know, right now I don't want to own its stock, I like the company, maybe it's the debt that's really cheap, I'm going to pick that up. And that's what we've been trying to do more of as we evaluate opportunities in that sector. But, you know, it has a lot of things working against it, oil does. Number one, strengthening dollar. All commodities pretty much are priced in dollars. If it goes up, it goes down. Number two, supply, a ton of supply, and even more really coming in light of the Iranian situation, and demand's down. So when you have those three things working against you, you're probably going to see oil stay down. In fact, Rod, there's a lot of pretty smart guys and gals out there that follow this stuff to say, hey, don't be surprised if you see this thing get into the low 40s and possibly even tickle down in the 30s somewhere.
Yeah, there are many people. There are even some predicting in the 20s. There are a lot of predictions at 35. Some of the people I follow more closely, especially some of the energy analysts, mm-hmm. Pavel down at Raymond James is one I follow pretty closely in what he puts out. He feels as though we've probably put a bottom in. Doesn't mean we aren't going to retest the bottom. And he has even said it's very likely you'll retest the bottom, but he hasn't thought that the energy or oil will go a lot lower than what we have already seen it.
Yeah.
But yes, he does expect to retest. Now, of course, I haven't heard Pavel speak since this deal is on the table and what happens with Iran and whether or not that changes his view. But before today and the deal, that's been his view on the oil, is that we'll probably retest that low, but he hasn't been one that has felt as though we'd see a three handle or a two handle on oil.
Well, we can look at all markets, including oil, that markets move on speculation and then later adjust on reality. And I think probably the talk about Iran and their oil supply might be just a little bit overrated. Real quick, Rod, before we have to take a break, biotech rally fuels bubble worries for sure. That's been in the Wall Street Journal a lot. I mean, there's no question that On Fire doesn't even do that sector justice.
Yeah, no, it has really had a rapid run up. Now, of course, so far this year and in the last month and a half, it's really had a big pullback. What I would say is there's really two different biotech markets. There is the well-established, strong, good cash flow, plenty of products on the market, making money today, biotech, and they're fine. Their earnings are not way out of whack. Those are high-growth companies, so they're not cheap PEs, but they're also not outrageous PEs if you look at the growth rate. Then you have the biotech companies that are still trying to get more than one drug on the marketplace, or maybe a single drug in the marketplace. Those are the ones that are most definitely at risk, because even though some of the early phase 1, 2, 3 trials look good, it doesn't guarantee that it ends up going to market and becoming a blockbuster drug. So yeah, I think there's two different marketplaces. I hate when people just throw it at the sector there's a bubble, because you have to look at the individual stories to determine whether or not there's a real bubble.
Yeah, another
out
area
there
that you should have professional management in. I mean, that's an area that I know you get all excited about a particular company or something, you try to throw a bone at it and hope for a big hit, and that's okay sometimes, but if you're trying to play that sector, definitely seek out professional advice. We're going to take a break. When we come back, just have a few minutes left. So we're going to wrap up the show. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back. You know, if you missed any of the show and you'd like to hear it again, it will be up online soon on WGCLradio.com. And always Saturday mornings, 9 o'clock, you can catch the replay. So we hope you do that, because it was a fun-filled, packed show of information from Rod Holloway, Eric Geisler. And Rod, thank you again for being part of the show. Good, insightful stuff as always. And, of course, people can hear you on Glass of the Morning at 7:19 and a half sharp.
Yeah, that's right.
And Monday morning,
usually a little bit later on
Mondays.
On Fridays, because you got Big Show Friday. You got Chuck Crabb in the studio, so there's usually a little more to talk about. And especially because Chuck's rolling in at a little after 7 before I go on, so sometimes it's a few minutes later than that.
But if you haven't heard it, you see why I have Rod around, because he really makes me look good. Wednesdays I call in and talk about fishing and whatever in the show. That's easy stuff. Rod actually has to bring the meat and potatoes to the show. Next week, we'll have a show for you. We had originally scheduled Ed Slott, the country's IRA distribution expert, but he is knee-deep in tax season, so we had to boot us till May. But the following week, Jerry Sedler, the author of Don't Retire, Rewire, will be our guest. And, of course, she has been on several times, but it kind of helps people identify your drivers. You know, what gives you those attaboys? What gets you out of bed when you're working? Why do you work beyond the paycheck is the question she always asks. She has a great book, Don't Retire, Rewire, so it's for folks that are kind of approaching and then moving into that phase of retirement. And don't forget to check out online Today's Guide to Retirement Planning, a resource for adults age 50 and over. It's the book that Doug Hughes and myself, David Hayes, wrote. It's about 160 pages long. You get it for $3.50 on Amazon as the ebook, and it's $16.40 or something like that in the paperback version. So it's pretty cool. Check it out. We hope you do. We're going to be talking more and more about this as time goes on. So, great guys, have a great rest of the week. We'll talk to you again next Thursday. Goodbye. Discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Guest opinions on this show do not necessarily represent those of the radio station, David Hayes, or CFCI. You should always consult with an investment professional before making important investment decisions. Investment advice offered through CFCI, an SEC registered investment advisor, 674 South College Avenue, Bloomington, Indiana.